And now what I will try to tell you a little bit about, if I will find my presentation. Yeah. Is about the engineering prospects. Something, you know, we can, I try to give you my perspective about what is engineering. And I try to be a little bit provocative, trying to say that synthetic biology, or what we today define as synthetic biology, can actually lead for a new green revolution. So we had Lewis talk about the first green revolution, that, you know, without it, we wouldn't be here today. We do not have the food that we actually can consume. But there is a dire need for another green revolution. So the problem is that human population keeps growing. It could be good, but it also could be bad. So these are the estimation by the UN about how human population could continue growing. And it could be that in the lifetime of most of us, we will reach the 10 billion score for human population. And the question is, how are we going to feed all of us? It was calculated that in order to be able to avoid global famine, we need to almost double agricultural production. So this is again an analysis that was made, which is quite nice. You see here how the yield, agricultural yield for the four main calorie sources for humanity were improved from the late 60s and up to 2010. You see that there is a consistent growth, but in order to double agricultural production, we need to follow this dashed line. And if you project from how we progress so far, this is this line. So we see that there is a huge difference between the level of progress we are currently sustaining in agricultural yield to that we actually need to do. And this is a big problem. Maybe not, we don't feel it here in Europe or in Northern America because we actually have too much food here. But in the developing world, this problem is already quite apparent. And even if we redistribute our food, which is, of course, another problem why people get hungry today because the food is not distributed equally. But even if we redistribute everything in an equal manner, soon there will be not enough food to feed everyone. So how do we solve it? A major factor that limits agricultural productivity is the low efficiency and rate by which plants use light to take CO2 from the air and fix it into biomass, in this case, sugar, that from which biomass can be derived. So the details here are not important. What's important is that what plants are doing, basically, they use light to split water and take CO2 from the atmosphere to convert it into biomass. And this process is quite an inefficient process. Now, here you might wonder to yourself, plants have evolved for millions, hundreds of millions of years. Plant breeding, as we are doing in our culture, is being done for thousands of years. So here I give, for example, the famous Mendel experiment. But of course, we are doing plant breeding since we discovered agriculture, which means thousands of years. So one would expect that during this very, very long time cycle, carbon fixation will reach optimality, that there will be nothing else that we could do in order to improve it. So how come the process is still so inefficient? And what I would like to claim that what plant evolution and plant breeding has in common is the fact that both of them work as a tinkerer rather than engineer. And this is based on the famous quote that evolution itself can be viewed as a tinkerer. And many of you might ask, what exactly is a tinkerer versus engineer? So let me explain, because I think this distinction is essential for our understanding of what we can and cannot do using rational design of natural processes. So a tinkerer is a guy or a girl or whatever that takes an existing machine, existing system, and play with it, change it. You can make it a little bit better, a little bit different, but the starting point is a starting point of an already existing system. And this is, of course, how evolution works. So you have an already existing system, let's say a bacteria, and this bacteria evolves to do something a little bit different, or something a little bit better. And throughout the ages, it changes and changes and changes until it reaches the situation that you have a human being standing here and human beings sitting there. But this is not an engineer, because an engineer starts from scratch. Engineer takes the design principle of the system to understand what would be the optimal solution for a given problem. So basically, if we look at it from the point of view of how to reach optimality, how to reach maximality, the point of view of a tinkerer is very limited. A tinkerer can see only its immediate surrounding, so it can climb a mountain because it sees the immediate surrounding, which part is becoming higher and higher and higher, but then it gets stuck at a local maximum. While an engineer looks at it from a bird's view and can actually see what is the local optimum that can actually solve the particular problem in the best possible manner. Therefore, an engineer has always an inherent advantage over a tinkerer, and this is why, despite of millions of years of evolution and thousands of years of plant breeding, we still have a lot to improve when it comes to carbon fixation. But now we have a problem. Even if we accept that engineering is the right approach, we cannot just engineer biological system as we engineer a mechanical system. An electrical engineer, a mechanical engineer, know exactly all the parameters that govern his or her system. And therefore, he or she can design a really good solution. However, biological systems are chaotic. By chaotic here, I mean the scientific definition of chaotic. So everyone here probably knows the cliché of a butterfly clapping its wings in one place, and in the other side of the world you have a hurricane. But of course, this cliché also holds a grain of truth. Basically, a chaotic system is a system which is extremely sensitive to changes in its input. And according to these minute changes, huge changes in the output or in the behavior arises. And of course, engineering such a system is very difficult. How can you exactly predict what is going to happen to your system if you know that if you change it a little bit, every small noise can be amplified? The trajectory, this chaotic trajectory, also prevents us in some cases to understand the causality within the system. Why did we get a certain behavior when he did this or that? Okay, so how do we do it? How do we engineer a chaotic system? First, you need to not be very vain and say, don't say to yourself that you know the optimal answer and there is only one answer that you need to try to implement, but try to think about multiple solutions or engineer multiple solutions, knowing that even if one fails, you still have the others that you can rely on. Second, you want to try and focus on parts of the system which are less chaotic than the other. I will give you an example in a few seconds, but just think about it. In an entire system, there are always parts which are very connected to all other parts, and then they tend to be very chaotic because every change you make to them will influence the entire system, while other parts of the system could be poorly connected, and then they would be more stable. And finally, and probably the most interestingly, is that if you really want to be a good engineer, you should also use the gifts that nature gives you and the tools that nature is using itself. And this, of course, requires a lot of explanation, which I will give you in a second. But I would want to shift now to actually go back to the question that I raised of how to engineer better carbon fixation and how we implement this logic into carbon fixation. So, as said, the natural process of carbon fixation is quite inefficient, and we need to engineer a better solution. If we look at the carbon fixation process, I give you here a schematic way to look at carbon fixation. Each arrow here represents an enzyme. Enzyme is a protein, it's the machinery of the cell. Basically, we are all composed of enzyme doing metabolic work that enable us to live. The stars represent the compounds in the cell, so each enzyme converts one compound to the other and another compound to the other, and so on and so forth. As you can see in this process, CO2 is being assimilated, and there is some biomass precursor that is being produced that enable the plant to grow and multiply and so on. Now, if we try to change the carbon fixation pathway itself, this would not be a smart idea because this part of the system is very high, it's highly connected to all parts of plant metabolism. It's a very chaotic system. So this is exactly not the part on which we would like to focus. So instead, we decided to focus on another process which relates to carbon fixation, which is called photorespiration. So photorespiration is a essential process. You must convert this product into back into the system. But the problem of natural photorespiration is that it releases CO2. And this, of course, directly counteracts what we would like to do, because we would like to fix CO2, and here we have a system that actually releases CO2. So we came and thought how we can solve this problem using engineering tools. So we designed pathways, metabolic pathway that contains new enzyme that would be able to bypass photorespiration without the release of CO2. And this means that you keep much more carbon in the system, and this could support the growth of the plants and boost agricultural productivity by up to 60%. So this is really, you know, a true engineering approach. And it's also a true engineering approach because we thought about this enzyme not by thinking about existing solution, but actually really designing stuff or processes from scratch, a de novo engineering. So how do we do it? How do we engineer the missing enzyme that will be able to support this process? So here come the enzyme engineering logic into place. So what enzyme engineers are usually doing, they are taking existing enzyme and they change them rationally so they will be able to make a new process. So basically, this is funny, what the enzyme engineers are doing is similar to tinkering because they start with an existing enzyme and tinker it to make a new enzyme. So it's a combination of the engineering and tinkering. Okay, the problem is that enzyme engineering can take us not very long or not very far because it's a very laborious process. As you can see here, there are many steps, it's very costly, it's very tedious. Every cycle of this it takes you a lot of time and money. Also, testing this pathway directly in plants is also very tedious because plant metabolic engineering is still a challenging process and it restricts the amount of how many cycles you can check. So what we need is a technology to enable us to take this unevolved enzyme or still rather poor enzyme and be able to optimize them in the most efficient manner. And what we are doing, what we specialize in, is using bacteria as a platform to take an unevolved pathway, to improve it and optimize it before we then can be express it in plants to support a better carbon fixation rate. So you might ask yourself what bacteria has to do with all of the process because bacteria is not doing photosynthesis. So let me explain to you by focusing on the bacteria. Bacteria usually converts its food, usually sugar, into essential cellular components that enable them to grow and multiply. We engineer the bacteria such that it cannot produce one of its essential components anymore. And then we introduce the new pathway as the only way to produce this essential component. Therefore, we couple between pathway activity and bacterial growth. No pathway activity, no growth. Low pathway activity, low growth. High pathway activity, high growth. We grow the bacteria for many generations in just a few weeks, something we could never do with plants. And during this short life cycle, fast evolution takes place. Changes to pathway enzyme emerge spontaneously, and the best pathway variant arises naturally as it outgrows its competitors and takes over the bacterial population. So basically, while the project is starting as an engineering project, something we designed de novo, we let nature do the improvement by using nature on tricks, which are, again, natural selection. Okay, so the last thing I want to show you is a little bit how we do all of this bacterial growth. And this you can see here, I hope at least, yeah. So this is probably the smallest place in which we can do a gross experiment, each of... Okay. Sorry. Wait, you're not...
I hope it's working now.
Do you hear me? Yeah. Assuming, okay. So let me show you a little bit. So this is the smallest place in which we can actually grow the bacteria. This is called 96 well plate. So each of these holes is a well. In each of these well, we can put 150 microliter, which is a very small amount, of cells. And you can see that we can grow 96 different bacteria here at the same time in a machine that checks it all the time and control the temperature, so we can characterize all of these strains simultaneously. On the other hand, the biggest machine that we are using is this one, and this I think is especially interesting. So here is when we are doing the evolution. I said that we put the strain that we want to evolve for higher pathway activity and grow them for many generations. This is the device. So basically, we put a culture, a medium in this part, containing the cell. Here there is a small propeller, I guess, I hope that you see it here, that makes them all the time moving, so they'll get aerated, air will go inside. And you can see here all the complex, it looks a bit like a spaceship, all the complex input and outputs that goes into the bioreactor. So this is the fresh media that we are putting in and the old media going out. And this could sustain continuous growth of the bacteria here for days, weeks, months. During this time, we can actually do the evolution and get for higher pathway activity. Thank you. And Helena, will you join me?